The Spectator's podcast now have a newsletter. Sign up for free at spectator.co.uk/podcast-highlights to get the Spectator's podcast highlights in your inbox every Monday.
Hello and welcome to the Spectator's Books podcast. I'm Sam Leith, the literary editor of The Spectator, and this week I'm extremely pleased to be joined by Kate Telcher, who is the author of a new book about the amazing palm house that's the centrepiece of Kew Gardens, and it's called Palace of Palms, Tropical Dreams and the Making of Kew. Kate, welcome. Now, we now think of Kew Gardens as an absolute staple part of London's touristic landscape. But when your story begins, its very future was kind of in doubt, wasn't it?
Well, yes, I start my story with the government inspection of Kew. This is at the moment when Queen Victoria has just ascended to the throne and there's a review of royal household spending. And there's a question about whether the royal household should keep on the gardens or if they're just a drain, an unnecessary drain on the expense. So there's this elaborate report that's conducted by, among others, John Linley, who's the secretary of the Horticultural Society, and Joseph Paxton, who's the gardener of the Duke of Devonshire. And they go all the way around the gardens, the botanic gardens. At that stage, it's really just quite tiny. It's just 11 acres. And it's in bad repair. So they write their report. In fact, it's John Linley who writes the report. And he really advises that there are kind of two options. His favourite option is that you build up and expand this botanic garden and you actually make it a public botanic garden, worthy of the nation and indeed of use to the empire, or that it's abandoned. And this report sat around for a couple of years, and then reports came out that actually that option of kind of abandoning Kew became more likely, and there was great concern, and letters to the Times were written, and there were questions in the House of Parliament, and it became a matter of public concern. And it was at the point that the gardeners were instructed to change the hothouses into sort of stoves to grow exotic fruits in, that the whole collection was to be disbanded, that things started to change. There was this outcry and Kew was saved for the nation.
A point you make, actually, that's kind of seems to bear here is that at that point, it seemed very odd, didn't it, to a lot of people that even though Edinburgh and, you know, most of the European capitals had really serious botanic gardens, London didn't have one in that same sort of, you know, in a way that would compete with the ones in, say, Berlin or whatever. And these things, you know, we were the heart of empire and it seemed like a very obvious thing for us to have. You know, these samples weren't even available and...
Yes, it was seen as a sort of source of national shame that there was no great and indeed publicly funded, government-funded botanic garden. And, you know, it was always right from the start seen as a potential kind of boon to empire. And it was imagined as being a kind of at the hub of this network of colonial botanic gardens, which could exchange plants. And so that if a plant grew in one colony in one part of the world, it could be possibly transplanted to another place which had similar climatic conditions with sort of untold profits. So it was always a kind of imperial and commercial venture from the start. And that was one of the ways that the government funds were justified.
Yeah. Now, Queen Victoria, slightly dismayingly, didn't seem to give much of a toss about the subject.
Well, certainly when she was younger, she really, yes, couldn't care less about the botanic garden. And it was only really with her marriage to Prince Albert, who was interested in things scientific and was interested in gardens. And there was a much longer history of sort of German interest in botany and gardens, that she too decided that she might become interested. And in fact, they were sizing up Kew Palace, that wonderful red brick building, as a possible kind of a place for their growing family to spend the night, you know, if they were to come down to Kew from Buckingham Palace.
Now, as you say, there's this sort of period of great interest and expanding interest in botany. I mean, one of the kind of remarkable, you know, attractions of your story is there sort of walk-on parts for Darwin's in there, Humboldt's in there, Lord Alfred Russell is in there, that, you know, sort of almost every sort of great Victorian botanist seems to have a sort of walk-on part. Did you know that was going to happen when you started?
Well, the book kind of grew and grew, really. But the reason that all of these people have their bit parts is that the first director of Kew, Sir William Hooker, and then his son, who becomes the second director, Joseph Hooker, really kind of helped to establish the discipline of botany through this extraordinary network of correspondence. So Sir William Hooker had been professor of botany at Glasgow University, and he was longing to come back down south, and always set his sights on being the director of Kew as a public botanic garden. And he schemed and manipulated his way for, you know, years before he finally got the prize. But anyway, he built up his own private herbarium, that is a collection of dried plants. He built that up through this network of correspondence, and that's how botany worked. You corresponded with each other. So he's corresponding with Humboldt from the time that he is professor of botany, and it is the way of acquiring specimens and information from across the world.
And tell us a little about Hooker's sort of arrival in place, because as you say, he did have to scheme a bit, and there seems to be in the race, if you like, to become the director, it starts to emerge this kind of sense of the difference between these sort of rather aristocratic professors of botany and the, you know, working plants men. I mean, his rival being, you know, John Smith, who was already at Kew.
Yes, well, he may have been a rival or may not have been a rival, but yes, there is certainly a distinction between, I wouldn't quite call them aristocratic, the professors. They are gentlemen, but not quite gentlemen, because they have to kind of work for a living. But one of the reasons that Sir William did finally get the position was actually he was prepared to take it at a reduced salary. He was so keen to get this job that you know, he was he had enough private income, really, to be able to take the reduced salary. But at the same time, he also had to have other sort of ventures on the side. So he had this whole network of publishing. So he's got all of these botanical journals and magazines, and some of them really quite popular ones, which he's sort of supplementing his income as well. So he's quite entrepreneurial too. But yes, there is a distinction between the sort of botanical scholars and scientists and the gardeners, the horticulturalists. And John Smith, whom you mentioned, was the head gardener at Kew from the time that it was a royal botanic garden to the time that it became the public botanic garden. And he came from very humble origins. He left school, I think, at 13. He taught himself Latin with the help of a dictionary so he could study botany, because of course everything was in sort of botanical Latin. He comes down to London, like many Scottish gardeners, they come south for employment, and he gets employed in the Royal Gardens at Kew. And then through his own sort of hard work and study becomes a real expert in ferns, and so he's a self-taught botanist. And also very much a practical gardener. And in the gardening press, he's sort of another candidate for the possible position of director of Kew. The extent to which he really believed he would be a candidate, I'm not quite clear. But certainly Hooker, when he arrived, thought that John Smith looked really grumpy, because he thought that maybe it was his job, really.
Now, as you go on, as you say, the Palm House becomes the great centrepiece project, and we'll talk a bit about how it came about. But can you start by saying a bit, you know, what did the palm mean to Victorians, because it seems to be layered with signification and meaning and economic importance.
Yes, well, the Victorians inherited the idea from Linnaeus that palms were the princes of the vegetable kingdom, so that they were the most noble, most beautiful and most useful of all plants. So they're really the ultimate plant, and they kind of far surpass anything that Europe has to offer. So the idea of palms as being boundlessly fertile, so they can provide every possible necessity for human life. In fact, Linnaeus also thought that early mankind had subsisted entirely on palms. And Humboldt invented a lovely word for this. He said that early mankind had been palmivorous, so just eating palms. But not only eating palms, and palms could provide kind of wine, oil, but also building materials, clothing, and any number of useful tools, or indeed musical instruments, or palm leaves for writing. So there's this whole idea that the palm is the most bountiful, most useful of all plants. And on top of that, you also, of course, have a kind of biblical pedigree with the date palm, which is, again, lovely, upright, virtuous, all sorts of associations with the palm in the Judeo-Christian tradition. And then on top of that as well, the kind of association of palms with life of ease and luxury in the tropics, and coconuts being again the most bountiful and useful of plants. So yes, I mean, there are many layers of meaning there, just cultural ones, not to mention the commercial ones as well.
Now, once they decided, we're going to have this some form of palm house, I mean, there was the great inspiration for it. You mentioned Paxton earlier, but they had a model, didn't they, which they had to sort of more or less equal or surpass.
Yes, well, Paxton was the gardener employed by the Duke of Devonshire at Chatsworth. And Devonshire was the most ambitious and ostentatious of aristocrats, in terms of wanting to build up his garden. And in Paxton, he found just the ideal, innovative, creative gardener who not only, not only made landscape the gardens tremendously, built him an enormous arboretum, but also built the largest, most spectacular conservatory of all. So the great stove or conservatory at Chatsworth was immense. It had a sort of aisle down the centre which was so wide you could drive a carriage. It was landscaped. It had tropical plants from all over it. It was one of the kind of the wonders and glories, certainly of Derbyshire, but also of Britain. But it was this aristocratic glasshouse, and glasshouses really were the preserve of the aristocracy. Incredibly expensive to build, to stock, to run. So this was the model, and indeed Hooker thought it sort of slightly inappropriate that this most glorious of glasshouses should be aristocratic, and he wanted a public glasshouse that would vie with Chatsworth. And initial designs were really kind of based on Paxton's Chatsworth model. And indeed, the architect who had been associated with the conservatory at Chatsworth became the architect associated with the palm house at Kew. So there were links. But then entering into the story, we have Richard Turner, the wonderfully innovative iron founder and engineer from Dublin, and he makes the palm house something special and quite different.
He's sort of the hero of your book, in a sense, isn't he?
Well, yeah, I'm very taken with Turner. He's incredibly ambitious and incredibly enthusiastic and energetic, and he really, really wants to make his name with a design that he says, is going to be as near as perfection as you could possibly imagine. And he sort of pulls out all the stops to create a palm house that will, as he say, be worthy of the nation and will make his name too as well.
Well, you mentioned that he was sort of, I don't know, maybe saddled is the wrong word, but he was conjoined with an architect, the same architect who was involved in the great stove at Chatsworth. I mean, is this again this funny two-tier thing in Victorian society that, you know, just as there was the, you know, the botanist and the gardener, the idea that a kind of iron founder could actually design this great thing was a bit below the salt. I mean, you know, he didn't get credit for essentially inventing the glasshouse, did he?
Well, certainly not during his lifetime, and really not until the 1980s was Richard Turner credited properly. I think there were perhaps sort of two reasons for this. You know, one was the class reason, that he was a tradesman, really. He's an iron founder. He's not a professional architect. He's not well connected. Decimus Burton, the architect, is fantastically well connected. His father, James Burton, built sort of vast swathes of London. Lots of Bloomsbury were built by Burton. And so his own son was in a good position when he was trained as an architect to land major commissions. So Decimus Burton, from a young age, was doing things like laying out Hyde Park and Green Park and designing Hyde Park Corner. So he's very used to aristocratic circles. He's incredibly clubbable. So you've got him on the one hand, and on the other hand, you've got Turner, who comes from Dublin. So there are lots of kind of colonial assumptions that mean that he has to, fight against all the prejudices against Irish workmen whom he employs, and the idea that an Irishman could be a brilliant engineer and innovative designer as well.
Yes, and his engineering skills, which are obviously sort of largely self-taught.
Entirely self-taught, yes. But that's not unusual. That's not unusual in glasshouse design. I mean, Paxton as well is a self-taught engineer, designer of extraordinary structures. So, yes, at this stage, you know, the glasshouse is this interesting kind of a structure that is halfway between architecture and engineering, and is often designed, or elements of it are designed, by people who are, you know, have more of an interest in horticulture than anything else, because it's functional and it has to, you know, it has to be properly adapted for the plants, you know, in terms of getting enough light. I mean, that's the big problem in this murky climate of ours, is getting enough light for the plants.
And there's some sort of fascinating detail about how, I mean, at least to start with, you know, Turner will come up with a design, Burton will redraw it, Turner will get wind of it and quietly appeal to Hooker on the side, saying, you know, he's ruining my designs. You know, what were the innovations that Turner made that others couldn't see?
It's Turner and his foreman, and unfortunately I couldn't find out the foreman's name, and it may well be that most of the genius lies with the foreman rather than with Turner. but together they devised a way that they could span a kind of unprecedented width with just a single row of arm of cast iron columns on either side. What they're doing is they're using wrought iron, and they get this much greater width span of the arches. And then what Turner also discovers is that he's kind of reading about in the engineering press, and he discovers a new patent that's just been taken out for building iron ships. And he decides that maybe he could use this kind of deck iron, it's called. It's a form of wrought iron. And the new kind of patent, he maybe has a structural use. And so that what he's doing is essentially taking ideas from shipbuilding and applying them for the first time to fixed structures. So
That's his great innovation, and he is, yes, he's always trying to kind of smuggle them past Decimus Burton, and it's his great moment of triumph when his wrought iron arches are tested and they're proved to be stable and safe, and Decimus Burton must acknowledge his genius. At least that's the way that Turner sees it.
Yes. Now, there's and also the detail that it's wrought iron rather than cast iron. There's a kind of slightly tragic aside about a cast iron building that goes wrong.
Yes, that's the Antheum at Brighton, which was this extraordinary, enormous glass house that was, I think it was a dome that was meant to be bigger than the dome of St. Peter's at Rome. And it was made of cast iron ribs. And I think the moment that they removed the scaffolding, these ribs sort of started to swerve and give, and then the whole thing just collapsed in a shower of sparks. And I think that the kinds of remains remained as sort of the ruins of it remained for several years as a kind of melancholy reminder of this great kind of failed project. Yes, so there were many of these ambitious glasshouse ideas at the time.
Quite high stakes. Now, the glass itself, again, the most modern sort of careful experimental science went into determining that, didn't it?
Yes, well, it was sheet glass, which is in itself a kind of relatively new technology. But the particular thing that was interesting was the tint of the glass, because it wasn't clear as it is these days, but it was actually tinted this very pale shade of green. And that shade was determined through a series of experiments by a chemist and photographer by the name of Robert Hunt. Now, Hunt, he's another sort of self-made man. He's a scientist who gets very interested in, you know, both the new sort of technology of photography and the effects of light on plant growth. And he carries out a number of experiments with using coloured glass and seeing if that affects plant growth. And so he's the kind of go-to man if you want to think about light and plant growth. Because one of the problems with the structure, the size of the palm house with so much glass, is the danger of scorching. So that the leaves of the plants might actually be exposed to too much heat. So they were trying to find a shade of glass that would prevent scorching but allow plants also to grow in a healthy way. So, yes, Robert Hunt conducted a series of experiments using the extracted juice of palm leaves and photographic paper and different coloured glass to see which one was best suited. And he ended up with a shade of glass that actually was really quite like the shade of glass, that green glass that had fairly traditionally been used in horticultural structures for, you know, similar reasons. So John Smith, the curator, the head gardener at Kew, and who was always very sceptical of anything scientific, sort of said, "Well, yeah, surprise, surprise, you know." He's you know, all these scientific experiments, which, you know, he's very doubtful about, you know, how could anyone conduct these experiments on in the depths of winter on palm juice extracted from palm leaves? And, you know, this is all nonsense. He's saying, anyhow, surprise, surprise, they've ended up with, you know, what we knew would work anyway.
Yes. And speaking of sceptics and malcontents, you know, we haven't touched on the outgoing, you know, former director of Kew, who, you know, flounced with all his toys and took all the botanical records home. And when they were starting to build the palm house, magnificent structure that is, he said, repeatedly, didn't he, "You're building this in completely the wrong place."
Well, actually, maybe with justice. The person who objected to the place was John Smith.
Oh, it was Smith, was it? Sorry.
So, yeah, no. Smith is always... So John Smith is always the voice of kind of doom, or well, No, John Smith, because he knew the gardens so well, knew that the site that they had chosen to build the palm house on was the site of a former lake that was partly silted up and that was boggy and that was liable to flood. And the palm house, which had basement rooms for its boilers, and it also had a tunnel that connected the boiler rooms with the chimney, or which was disguised as an Italian campanile, a bell tower. So he always from the start suspected that this tunnel and the basement boiler rooms would flood, and he was proved right. And although he had some satisfaction in being proved right, he also had the real problem of trying to keep these boiler rooms dry and pumping them out. They had kind of fire engine pumps down there and labourers pumping out in these incredibly hot, awful conditions, just trying to keep the water from getting in the boilers, because it's really difficult to run boilers when you've got damp coke. And so Smith is always complaining about the site, and it's a practical problem for him.
I don't think you touch on it. Is that problem, obviously they're not running the boilers on coke anymore, but is that problem resolved in the modern palm house?
Yeah,
or are they still wishing
it
somewhere dry?
It is. That's not the problem, and they don't run it on coke anymore. It's all rather sophisticated. The boilers are actually kind of located quite near where the campanile is. And the whole palm house was renovated extensively in the 80s, which is actually when they created a basement area which formerly had an aquatic display and aquariums and things. That's no longer open for health and safety reasons, I believe. There's no problem there anymore, no problem with flooding.
And in terms of stocking it, how did that take place? How did they go about it? Obviously, they had some palms already.
Yes, they had palms. They had glass houses on the old botanic garden, but these were far too small, and the palms kept on smashing the glass. That's always the problem when you have palms, is that they grow really, can grow anyway, really quite quickly, and they've got this very tough kind of growing spike at the top, and that can just break through panes of glass. In fact, it still does so today in the palm house at Kew. But yeah, they had to transport some of these great palms from the old buildings, which had to be dismantled. The palms themselves had to be kind of dug out of these big kind of brick beds that they were in incredibly heavy and big palms and enormous roots had to be put on these rolling platforms. And I think they had to be rolled about sort of half a mile into the new building. And then they had to use lifting gear from the dockyards. So they had windlasses and winches and things to get them in and into position and then upright again. So that they had the palms that were on site at Kew, but they also had full-grown palms that were donated by aristocrats, like Sir George Staunton, who had an estate at Lee Park in Hampshire, and he had a palm that had outgrown his own glasshouse. So, yeah, he donated that. It had to be packed up in a special wooden case, and it was, I think, put on its own carriage on the railway, and it travelled the 72 miles all the way to Kew. So, yes, whole elaborate ways of stocking the palm house.
And as you say, you know, the palm house became a sort of central hub for all these botanic gardens around Empire. I mean, Hooker sort of used people, not least his own son, as ambassador come collectors, didn't he?
He did, indeed. So, sorry. Why don't you do your business?
Oh, sorry. I was just momentarily trying to take my 6-year-old out of the room. Sorry.
No, I realise that.
Trying to be.
Should we stop for a minute?
Trying to be as unobtrusive as possible, but unsuccessful.
I know. I realise. I mean, 6-year-olds happen. what were we saying?
You were just talking about this sense that it started to, you know, we had these extraordinary botanist heading up the Orinoco and, you know, Joseph Hooker being sent on very expensive expeditions to find rhododendrons and that sort of thing.
Yes, well, okay, so Joseph Hooker, William Hooker's son, was keen to make his name as a botanist, and to do that, really, you had to go on an expedition, and the further and more unknown, in botanical terms, you know, the lands that you could reach, the better. So when he was very young, Joseph Hooker managed to be appointed, you know, partly through his father's intervention, managed to be appointed botanist on the expedition to the Antarctic. So he was, it was also to set up these magnetic observatories all the way around the South Atlantic. So he went on this extraordinary expedition, and at every landfall he collected plants, both living and ones that he dried, which were sent back to his father as well to build the collection at Kew.
Do you think you could talk a little bit about, you know, how the story kind of, well, it doesn't come completely to an end, but how, you know, the Hooker era ends and we move into, well, the second Hooker era, if you like. It's a fantastically nepotistic story in some ways.
So William Hooker really had two main aims. One was the promotion of Kew, and the building of the Palm House, this great signature building, which is incredibly, you know, daring and innovative, as the centrepiece of Kew. That's one part of the story. But his other great aim really was the promotion of his son's career. And he not only managed to get Joseph appointed on these various expeditions overseas, but he also got him appointed assistant director, and finally managed to also engineer the succession, even kind of beyond the grave. Because one of Hooker's great kind of possessions, and what he used as a kind of bargaining tool, was his private herbarium. So this herbarium was the largest, most expensive, greatest private herbarium in Britain. And he said he would donate it to Kew at a very good price if his son were appointed director and successor. And so after Sir William's death, Joseph duly offered the herbarium to the government, who did buy it for a kind of a good, very good cheap price. And then, surprisingly, Joseph also became director of Kew. This
Poor
is not
John
to say
Smith.
That he was... And what about John Smith? But by that time, John Smith had retired and was nearly blind, was blind probably by then. But it's not to say that Joseph wasn't actually a very accomplished botanist and scientist and, you know, at the cutting edge of science of his day, but that, you know, he could not have done it without his father's help.
Yeah. No, and John Smith's ferns end up being put to good use, though, don't they? I mean...
John Smith's ferns are ended up in the Natural History Museum, where they remain today, and, you know, one of the kind of major important collections. And Smith in old age became almost completely blind, but he continued, he sort of outlived them all, and he wrote lots of books. He dictated books when he was blind. He had a secretary, and lots of popular botanical books. So, you know, he had the last word.
You say also that his entry in the DNB says that he wrote a history of Kew that was so candid nobody could publish it. Did you get to read it?
Yes, and that's where that's where all of these sort of grumpy and unflattering comments from Smith come from. Yes, so he has this kind of commentary about the Hookers that runs all the way through that. I mean, the thing about Smith is he is, you know, he's both incredibly loyal and devoted to Kew, and also very kind of sceptical about so-called scientific botanists who really know nothing about practical horticulture. And the other thing about him is he's completely in love with his plants. So he really hates it, you know, when the hookers go pruning in the palm house. I mean, you have to cut things down from time to time. They do, you know, outgrow the palm house. And, you know, these days too, they have to cut things down in the palm house. But for Smith, these are kind of terrible traumatic events. And he records the deaths of the plants in his journals as black days. So he says, you know, he knows the whole history of these plants, you know, the seeds they were grown from. He's nurtured them. He's put so much of himself into them. And he says, you know, cut down and dispose of them in as little care as if it were a common geranium, that kind of thing. So he's invested in his plants and he's grieved when they go.
Now, there's one plant they never quite get, that's the coco de mer, as we think of it, yes. The double coconut.
The double coconut is the most magnificent and fabled of all the palms. It's got a long history of kind of mystery. The coco de mer is famous because it has the largest seed and fruit in the plant kingdom. And the seed is also shaped like, it is thought to be shaped like female genitalia on one side and buttocks on the other. So it's always been this extraordinary curiosity. And it was much in demand in the 17th century in Europe. For cabinets of curiosity, these great sort of nuts were inlaid with silver and embellished and incredibly expensive. It's also used in Chinese medicine as a kind of universal cure-all and an aphrodisiac. And so they were incredibly sought after. Nobody in Europe knew quite where they came from, and they had kind of all sorts of fantastical tales. For instance, that they grew under the sea, and hence the French name coco de mer. But it was discovered in the 18th century that they actually grew on a very limited number of islands in the Seychelles. And they then became so exploited that they became very endangered, as they still are. But it was the kind of the great dream that Hooker had, that he should be able to show off a double coconut in his great new palm house at Kew. And he had the opportunity. It's really, really, really difficult to germinate a coco de mer. I mean, it remains really hard. However, a bohemian botanist by the name of Bodger, sent him, who's on Mauritius, sent him a germinated coco de mer. It had its own special barrel to be transported. It was on a great steamship. It was given a free passage because it was deemed to be such a precious botanical prize. It arrived in healthy state at Kew, and it didn't flourish. it survived for 2 years and then sadly died. And John Smith says, I think he had sort of 8 separate attempts to try to cultivate a coco de mer at Kew, and never finally succeeded. However, today there is a coco de mer in the palm house at Kew, so you can go along and see it, should you visit.
Well, a happy ending then. So go to Kew and see the coco de mer, and meanwhile read Kate's wonderful book. Kate Telcher, thanks very much indeed for your time.
Thank you very much, Sam. I enjoyed it.
You were listening to the Spectator's Books podcast. I very much hope you enjoyed it, and if you did, please do consider rating or reviewing us on the iTunes store. We'd love to hear from you.
The Spectator's podcast now have a newsletter. Sign up for free at spectator.co.uk/podcast-highlights to get the Spectator's podcast highlights in your inbox every Monday.